Wow. That's an incredible story. And even though the scale of that scene on the shore of the Sea of Galilee might have been a little different, and I don't imagine that the pundits were counting the attendees at this lakeside preaching event the way they have been counting numbers at the inauguration. I have a feeling that this crowd gathered around the Sea of Galilee when Jesus began his preaching career was not so much different than the crowd that was gathered in Washington this weekend for the events surrounding President Trump's swearing in. Crowds gather wherever the action is. And some in the crowd are very excited to be there. Some in the crowd are very skeptical about what's going on and they want to be there just so they don't miss a mistake. Some are downright angry and they're out to cause a little trouble. Some are maybe just hoping for a brush with celebrity. And I think most who assemble in the crowd are hoping that this new voice will bring some positive change, some better quality of life, some hope for a future that's different than the past. We come because we're seekers, all of us, seeking something in pursuit of a better life. And the question is, will this new thing, will this new ideology, will this new teaching, will this new person catch us up or not? I wonder, would you and I have been there? Would we have come out of our homes, away from our families or friends, away from our work to see Jesus that day that he put off from the shore to teach from the boat? Or would we have been at home watching the live feed on TV or checking our Twitter account for the messages that were flying from all of the different camps? Some of you know I got to spend last week down at the Gulf of Mexico down in Texas. And I'll tell you, after spending a week at the shore, I'm wondering, even if I'd been there with Jesus preaching from the boat, would I have paid any attention to him at all? Probably not, because I would have been so caught up looking at the shore birds or just looking at the play of the wind and the waves and feeling that beautiful, fresh air and the sunshine and looking at the children picking up shells along the beach or dancing in and out of the waves. I was at the beach for rest and relaxation. The last thing I wanted was to hear some preacher preach one more sermon about anything, especially on a beautiful day. And so I wondered, what would Jesus have thought about me if he had noticed me at the edge of the crowd, not paying particularly close attention to him? But then I realized I wasn't probably the only one who wouldn't have been paying attention. I wasn't the only one distracted at the beach. After such a lousy night of fishing, I imagine Simon and Andrew and James and John were probably pretty distracted too. I imagine they were burying their heads in their fishing nets, not because those unused nets needed any mending that day, but because they didn't want to meet the gaze of their neighbors who had come down to the seashore to see Jesus, but who would also have clearly seen that the men had returned from an all-night fishing trip without a single fish. I doubt that any of those fishermen heard a word that Jesus said, except when he asked them, "Hey, can I use the boat?" They were distracted about things that matter, like how they were going to take care of their families if their fishing slump lasted any longer, or how they were going to face their wives when they returned home empty-handed. Can you imagine the conversation that was waiting for them at home that day? Maybe you've been in their shoes before, feeling ashamed and knowing that someone is going to make your shame even worse by getting angry at you for failing at something that seems so totally out of your control. Even with GPS and sonar and radar, today's fishermen have to stay out weeks to fill their boats with a catch, and that's if they're lucky. No one is guaranteed success in this life, and the last thing you need is to have someone else remind you of just how fragile your hold on things really is, how close to the edge you're really living. We human beings are all so fragile, but you'd never know it to look at us. I'll tell you, I don't think I've ever prayed harder for a president coming into office than I've been praying for Donald Trump, because I sense that fragility even in him. It's in all of us. Even if you have to look really, really, really deep to see it, it's there. Some of you knew John Hoganson, a good, good man who was pastor, senior pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church. He came into that role about the same time I came into ministry here at Redeemer, and so we grew up in the neighborhood as colleagues in ministry, peers in the synod. And then he went on to Mount Olivet Church not long ago, the biggest church in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, to become their pastor, but was shortly thereafter diagnosed with brain cancer. And his funeral was last weekend while I was away. I was sad that I was unable to be there to honor him and to support his family in their time of grief. But I read some of the writings that he had posted on a blog in the last months of his life. He was a marvelous human being, and even in his dying, he was inspiring thousands of people with the power and strength of his faith and his love for his fellow human beings. And about a month ago, just a month before his death, he posted in a blog, you know, I had told you I wasn't going to write anymore because the exhaustion and fatigue from the radiation is taking such a toll that I just don't have the strength for it, but I felt compelled. It was as if God's Spirit was just compelling him to inspire others with wisdom that was coming to him, probably because he was dying. And this day, he wanted to share some thoughts, and these are his words about this very topic that we're talking about our human frailty. What breaks my heart, John said, is how so many people feel so unworthy, unlovable, and unacceptable. This last year and a half, many of you have shared with me your own physical, spiritual, and emotional struggles. I have been amazed by how many people feel inadequate, not good enough, unloved, and unacceptable to God and to everyone else in the world. He's naming something that's so foundationally true in our human experience. And the funny thing is, I'm reading a book now by Trevor Noah. Those of you who are more into pop culture than I am would recognize his name. He's the guy who took over The Daily Show from Jon Stewart, but I didn't know that. I was reading the book because he is a South African who grew up during apartheid and had a story to tell that I wanted to learn. Well, Trevor Noah is the son of a black African woman and a Swiss man. And during apartheid in South Africa, when he came into the world, it was illegal for them to have intimate relations. And so, did I say the title of the book? Born a Crime was the title of the book. And he could never, during apartheid, with both of his parents, he could never be claimed as their parents publicly. And so he had this very secretive childhood where he was in relationship, lived with his mom, but had a great relationship with his dad growing up. But when he turned 13, his dad moved to Cape Town. I think they were in Soweto. and his mom married another man, and then he moved into his teen years, where of course he got more interested in computers and video games and his friends than he was in spending time with his parents. And time just went on, and they didn't see each other for years. They lost touch completely as Trevor stayed busy living his life, finishing high school, heading into his 20s, becoming a comedian and starting to develop a reputation for himself, getting on the nightclub circuit where he was headlining in clubs all over the country and starting to do television shows and doing a lot of radio work. But in spite of his success, Trevor said, always those questions about his dad were at the back of his mind, bubbling up to the surface when he least expected it. I wonder where he is. Does he think about me? Does he know what I'm doing? Is he proud of me? Trevor wrote that when you're left in the lurch of not knowing, it's so easy to fill that space with negative thoughts. They don't care. They're selfish. But Trevor's mom always spoke well of Trevor's father, saying, Trevor, honey, he wanted you in his life. Don't ever forget that. He chose you. And she's the one who finally, 10 years later, convinces Trevor to find his dad again. And it wasn't easy because his dad left no forwarding address. Trevor had to track him down through the Swiss embassy, sent a letter to the embassy who said, well, maybe if he exists, if he's in the country, maybe we'll get him the letter. And so the letter eventually reached the dad, and the dad wrote back immediately. And when Trevor got word of where the dad was staying, he went immediately to Cape Town to see him. But he was so apprehensive, 10 years, and he didn't know if he'd even recognized his father at the senior apartment complex where dad was living those days. But as soon as he saw him, he knew, that's my dad. And he said, we picked up like we hadn't missed a beat, but we picked up at kind of the 13-year-old level. His dad had all his favorite 13-year-old treats. There was a big bottle of Sprite, and there was cream, a caramel custard, and there were roast potatoes. And Trevor said, I sat down, and thank goodness I still love the same foods I loved as a 13-year-old. So he's feasting on all these old favorites. And while he's doing that, you know, his dad doesn't have an appetite. His dad's just so delighted to see him. And he goes over and he picks up this big book, like an oversized photo album, and he brings it over to the table. And Trevor realizes it's a scrapbook about him. Every headline, every article, every picture, every little sentence about a nightclub gig that he had were in the book. And his dad is reading headline after headline, paging through the book, just beaming from ear to ear, so proud of his son. And Trevor was so overwhelmed with emotion, he said it was all he could do to keep from sobbing. For years, he said he'd had so many questions. Is he thinking about me? Does he know what I'm doing? Is he proud of me? And in this instant, Trevor knew his dad had been with him the whole time. He'd always been proud of him. Circumstances had pulled them apart, but he had never not been Trevor's father. Seeing his dad again confirmed for Trevor his dad's choosing of him. He chose to have Trevor in his life. He chose to answer Trevor's letter. Trevor was wanted. Being chosen, Trevor writes in his book, is the greatest gift you can give to another human being. And that's what Jesus did. These disciples didn't have a teacher. Nobody wanted to teach fishermen. They were at the low end of the pecking order, and they weren't even successful as fishermen. But Jesus, he didn't care about that. He saw their hearts and he loved them just as they were. He knew they weren't going to be A students. He knew that there might be some nights he'd go hungry if he depended on their fishing for his suppers. He knew they were imperfect. But he chose them. He chose to ask for their help. He chose to enable their amazing catch, not for themselves, I don't think, but for their families. He chose them as his disciples. He chose them. He wanted to be with them. He chose them. And friends, Jesus has chosen you. Simon Peter and Andrew and James and John left everything to follow him. Of course they did. He had given them the greatest gift that you can give another human being. And he has given you that gift too.